Welcome back to the Nerd Pub, episode 8. We are getting right up there in digits. With me, as always, is Mike. How are we doing?
Doing good, man. Better this time, actually. Less tired.
Reason. Good. That's
so I have
great.
A slightly different answer. Slightly different. Mildly different.
less tired is always better, though. We like less tired.
How are you?
Yeah, good, mate. I was just obviously saying before we jumped on that I'm having technical issues with my whole house, and it's frustrating. It's very annoying when
your
you just kind of
buggy.
Like you just want technology to work, and it's not, and it bothers me a lot because you buy these things and you're like, yeah, it's just going to talk to each other, and then I'm just going to have like one thing, and then the thing that you buy to like condense everything isn't working, and
totally, man. Yeah, because I was having a bitch to you about my hard drive issues. So obviously I'm recording this and I record the video. The video ends up being about 2.5 gig for the length of time we run. And I should have a lot more room than that. But I'm teetering between 2 and 6 gig all the time. And I have to keep micromanaging it because I cheaped out on like a N.2, one of those, you know, those thin wafer SSDs that are like super quick. And I cheaped out on it because they're more expensive. And this is like a year and a half ago. And I'm like, I'll just get a 256 gig one. I'll stick my operating system on it, any software that I use, like Photoshop, so it's lightning quick. And I'll point everything else that's data, you know, intensive, like game installations, to my other standard SSD. But, you know, as it turns out, a lot of apps force you nowadays to install to wherever the operating system is. So like I was just telling you about before, I tried to reinstall the Oculus Store. It's about 16 gig, and it will not let me install somewhere else unless I, like, run a command in the run prompts on Windows, targeting the .exe file, and I have to like change the default drive against that before I run it. It's just like, it's hiding shit. You know, I prefer the old school way where it's like, this is where it's going to install, and it's a piece of text, and I can just go, oh, change it to D drive or change it to fucking E drive, instead of having to like run weird fucking ghost commands. And it's like, come on, guys, come on. They're trying to make it too simple sometimes, which is kind of what you're saying. Like, plug and play is really, really good, right? Until you run into like a limitation and it doesn't do what you want, and then it's very hard to fix.
Yeah,
which is kind of a little bit of a problem.
I feel like it's like every time you go home to your parents' place and they're like, can you fix this for me? And then you're like, yeah, totally. And then it's like half the time it's like a really obvious issue, and then sometimes it's this absolutely freaking retarded thing that you're just like, I can't figure it out, I don't know why, I'm so sorry.
Oh, totally. And the amount of times I then go to explain, okay, so when you're logged into your emails on this browser, you can go to another one and log into a different email, and it's different. They're not the same email. And it's like, so even trying to explain something like that, like troubleshooting, oh, why is this tab not showing me what I thought? Or like, why is my printer not working? I then try to explain the user error, and it just, the language doesn't translate.
Yeah.
You know, there's bewilderment.
Actually, speaking of emails, I've got a good one. I've got a good weird thing for you. So my partner, who you know, has got herself the new iPhone. So she's got a 13 because her phone crapped out, and it was just like, hey, the new one just came
out. 13
may as well get that one. Yeah, great. It's a cool phone. But she's had a Google phone, the actual Google Pixel.
But
yeah, she's had a Pixel for a couple
of
years.
I've had a couple of Pixels, actually.
Yeah, they're great phones. I had one as well. I've had two, actually.
I oscillate between Apple and Pixel, depending on what the newest one is.
So I'm swinging right back to Apple because I've got the laptop and stuff now, and I just kind of like everything talking to each other. And that works, speaking of tech, talking to each other. But anyway, so she's got the new iPhone 13, and she was setting it up the other day, and she hasn't used her, like, Apple ID login for ages, right?
Oh, right.
So, you know, she goes to...
She gets caught in a two-factor loop?
Yeah. So, we're doing the authentication stuff, and it goes, oh, we've sent the code, you know, the authentication code to this laptop, which was the last time she logged in. That was the previous laptop to the one I have now.
Right.
So, which was coincidentally stolen out of the back of my car, but... Basically, what happened is, they sent it to a laptop that essentially doesn't exist anymore. So it's like,
you need to contact the thief and just be like,
can you guys
tell us the code?
But this laptop doesn't exist anymore. So it's like, okay, what do you do? And they say, oh, you know, we can't access that thing. And it's like, and Apple goes, no worries, we'll you'll be able to reset your password in 10 days.
Oh, nice. Okay, so lucky it's not urgent.
She basically had to set up a new Apple ID on an email that she doesn't use anymore just to set up a iPhone because there was no call-in number. And we tried like 1,000 different ways of resetting this password. But because she doesn't remember the old password because it was like 4 years ago,
yeah,
she can't reset her Apple ID properly. So now we're stuck with Apple being like, it's going to take us 10 days to authenticate who you are.
Stalemate.
Yeah, and totally. It's like, well, that's just, you know, and like I appreciate that level of security 100%. But this is where it gets super flawed with like that level of like encryption and security from Apple's point of view, because it's like, well, this person just got a new iPhone.
You can
they
get
have
locked
a very
out
specific
of your own
email they want to use, and you're telling them it's going to take 10 days to set it up. Like, that's insane. So
totally. You can get locked out of your own system. I've had that before. I get into a two-factor authentication loop where it's like, oh, I need to go to this email address, but it's an old email address.
Mm.
And it's the same thing. It's always going back to an old technology, like switching back to Apple or switching back to Pixel. And it's like, oh, it's an old email. And then I don't have the password for that. I can't remember it. So then I have to reset the password on that. But then the recovery email is a different email. And then, so I have to get into that in order to approve that. And so I can get into that in order to approve this one. And I've had it before where I've just arrived at like a cliff and I'm like, I can't. Yeah. My hands are tied. Like,
so
I'm fucked.
You've
like
just
I
gotta
can't,
wait for them to
I can't
do
get
that
in anywhere.
Yeah, you gotta wait for them to do the reset thing, and it doesn't fucking work. So
totally.
Well, it does work, it just takes a really, really long time, and then there's no number you can call to basically prove who you are. So then like you said, you get in this weird circular loop of, well, okay, I guess I'm just waiting for this to be reset. Great.
Totally.
And then, like, what happens once it's reset? She's already set up another Apple ID. She's set everything else up on her phone. So, it's like, well, now she's got two Apple
you end
IDs.
Up recommitting.
And you can't merge Apple IDs either. So,
yeah. What a nightmare. First world nightmare.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's totally like, oh, my God, my Apple ID. But, yeah, it's...
I, like, can't get into my
Yeah, I can't get into my brand new iPhone 13.
give me one sec. I've just noticed my waveform's quite high, and I just want to make sure my gain wasn't knocked. Just a second.
Cool. Meanwhile, we'll just keep talking
about how annoying
Apple is.
Weird. My waveform's really high, so hopefully the audio... I'm going to sit back from
the mic.
Sound
crisp and beautiful as always.
Amazing. on the tech thing, you know, things becoming maybe even too user-friendly and hiding options from you, and so when it's not fit for purpose, it gets very, very hard because the flexibility is kind of being taken away over time, right? As UX gets more refined and it's more for just a casual human user, it's called abstraction, and it creates abstract layers on top of the computer so that you become less and less aware as a user of how what you're doing is actually interacting with the machine, right? It's just everything now is like tiles and tapping, right? Mm. So this is so much of a problem that there's an article that's been going around. I saw it a little while ago, maybe a few months ago, and it just went around again. I saw it. And there's a professor who was doing some interview and talking to some tech website. And he was saying that there's a problem now with younger millennials, and is it Gen Z, the next one? I lose track of all these labels.
Yes, it's Gen Z. That's
it. Yeah, people who are coming into, you know, studying at college, and they're doing things like technical degrees. They'll be doing computer-related stuff, right? And there's a problem that he's noticing where people that are coming in now don't understand implicitly that computers use directories or folders and files. They don't understand it. Because they've grown up with computers being tap. You tap a button and basically you search for the thing you want, right? So people don't view their images. If you've only ever used, say, an iPad or an iPhone for most of your life, they don't necessarily view their images as a PNG or a JPEG, right? Because they're not interacting with it like that. It's just tile, and I have to log into the right account, and then it's magically available. And if I can't find something, I type into a search box, and that gives me my stuff. So he's like, in the past, you know, people saw computers, and this is how they were modeled, as like an office. You have folders,
yeah,
like manila folders in an office, right? You know, and your filing cabinets, and everything's kind of laid out like a tree, right? In this folder, there's this folder, there's this folder. And then you have your files. And we think like that, and we take that for granted. He said, to them, it's more like a computer is more like a basket of dirty laundry, with all laundry, like it's everything's heaped in one space together. And they have like a magical tool that they just say, I want my socks. And then their socks come to the top, right? Because they just use search bars. You go to Google and you go, show me this image. Bang, there it is. They never see how computers are working, which is interesting because it's almost like we're running into this trap of making things so usable and so intuitive that we're actually limiting people's understanding of how the tools work, which is kind of means that education has to be rewritten at that back end to make sure that those fundamentals are taught, which used to just be natural. Like they now have to be taught, oh, that underneath there's all this going on. And that gives them a bit of a disadvantage. But I thought that was pretty interesting. It's like, wow.
Yeah, I was just thinking like it'd be interesting to teach that concept to them though, right? Because obviously, you know, we understand like a filing system concept from the physical thing because we're pre-internet. We were alive before the internet, before iPhones.
Credit cards.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah,
I mean, we were like, kids for that, but I remember seeing that.
Mm. And so like if someone tried to explain how a file works in a computer, we would kind of instinctively understand that because we knew what it was like. We saw stuff before that mass adoption of that level of technology.
Totally.
Whereas, I guess whether you get like kids now, and you know, and I worked in digital marketing specifically to do with kids. You know, they call them the generation calling now, the nickname is called the glass generation because they've always got a piece of glass in front of them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's a horrifying thought, but yeah, it's exactly what's happening. So they're probably incredibly good at using the technology and understanding it, but not necessarily, I guess what you're saying is the backside of how all of that technology works,
because
they never had to, or they never saw what it was like before, like you're saying, like tiles and the level of I guess user friendliness that it is now.
Yeah.
I mean, the best example I always love, and you see like memes on it all the time, is basically like, you know, it's the year, you know, 2250, you know, we've got like holographs and stuff like this, but the save button on a computer is still a floppy disk.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because
totally.
Which 100% there's kids now who have no idea why the save button is a floppy disk and what a floppy disk is.
Totally. To them, that's just a convention.
Yeah.
It's just a thing that obviously we unanimously decided was the icon for that. And,
yeah.
And that's the only reason. Right?
Well, because it made sense at the time. When we originally started saving stuff, you saved it to a floppy disk. And,
you know,
that was fine.
Totally. And I think for them, this is kind of the extreme version of this conditioning. It's only going to get worse. But if I go back to kind of the experience we had where it was more intuitive, what I've learned actually is that we were already indoctrinated into an abstract version of that ourselves. Because when I went to study computer science, I had to unlearn and relearn fundamentals that I realized people in the 1950s and 60s who were around computers for the Genesis, they interacted with computers through text terminals and a keyboard.
Yep.
So they navigated file structure through typing commands like CD and then where I want to go, which is change directory. That's what you do on a Unix or a Linux system. And under the hood of like Mac OS, that's what it's running. It's doing that underneath. So when you double click a file or you right click and go new folder, under the hood, it's running a command, which is mkdir, which is make directory, make dir, and then the name of the folder. But we were even born in a time where I just right click and go new folder. So our graphical user interface was hiding a lot from us, but it was still somewhat visually representative of a folder structure. So it was probably easier for me to go to uni and go, oh shit, I got this culture shock now of realizing that even I've been, it's been abstracted away from me and I have to kind of concertedly force this into my brain now to learn how to use a text terminal because it's very useful and it's much faster and more powerful when you know how to use that.
Yeah.
And then I realized that already happened to me and us, and we take that for granted. And I only saw that because I went into the industry and I had to be exposed to that. But it didn't occur to me that it's even worse now. Like, and so when you get to a point where you say have things like Neuralink, you know,
yep,
brain machine interfaces, where I can think about what I want to search on Google and the results then are generated, that's even further abstraction because I don't even have to use a keyboard. And I don't have to associate search with lettering and semantics. I associate search with thoughts, which is now like an invisible way of interacting with the computer where I'm not even touching it anymore. And it's cool for everyday use, but there'll be situations where the amount of people that understand how that stuff works is going to get thinner and thinner.
Mm.
And so people will be less inclined to maybe even want to do it for a job because they don't think that way, right? They'd have to go and relearn everything. So that's pretty interesting.
It's interesting to sort of think that, you know, because it's very much like, oh, what's the Tom Cruise movie? Where he's got like the gloves and he's like doing the
Precognition and all that.
No, Minority Report.
Yes, Spielberg.
Yeah,
yes.
And that's cool. But even then, that was a sort of like this is what the future might look like. We're not going to need the gloves. They had to wear the gloves to track the finger movement. We don't need that anymore. And that was like 5 years later. But, you know, and a cool thing that's obviously a good way to look back at like 15 years of like tech, like where we've come in that amount of time is the Bond movies. And obviously the new Bond movies come out. And I'm very excited to see it.
So, I haven't seen the last couple of Craig ones, actually.
Yeah.
To get
but
that.
So Daniel, the original Daniel Craig Casino Royale came out, I think, 2006. Oh, yeah.
What a movie.
Phenomenal Bond movie. Fantastic. Genuinely think Daniel Craig is probably my favorite Bond, maybe.
Yeah.
I do love Connery. But if you go back and watch the Connery ones now, some of the scenes didn't age well.
Ask you a question.
Yes, Sean Connery. Joking. But some of the Connery stuff didn't age particularly well. Whereas some, you know, and some of the,
especially his misogyny, that didn't
that's
age
yeah, that's
well.
Kind of what I was getting at. But sure, let's just wave a flag at it. But anyway, so we go back to Daniel Craig. But there was like heaps of product placement in the Daniel Craig Bonds, right? Specifically with Sony. And one scene that jumps to mind is when he's in the Caribbean. Yeah, this is Casino Royale. So he's in the Bahamas looking for this guy. He's put a tracker on something. And
is this around when he walks out of the, is this that famous scene where he walks out of the water?
Yeah, it was famous scene where he walks out of the water, exactly. But he gets to that hotel using like an old Sony phone, like LCD screens and stuff were getting put into phones. Like this is just post Nokia, like 3210s.
Right.
And he's using, and I remember thinking, God, that's so cool that phones can do that now, that they can display that level of information. And then you go like, and then you watch the progression of, because they didn't go super gadgety in the Craig ones. They tried to stick much towards the source novels from Fleming.
Yeah, totally.
So, if you actually watch the progression, because this is like 15 years of Bond films, that the level of technology they started using, like as they sort of progressed throughout the film. So, it was like, okay, in the original Craig ones in 2006, we didn't have the iPhone yet. That didn't exist. So, that it was like, okay, we've got this shitty thing. And then, like, I think it was the next one, they had like a table that you could touch and...
Microsoft Surface computers.
Yeah, it was literally like a Microsoft Surface style thing. And then like the next one it goes, you know, like the technology, you just see those little leaps as you go forward in these movies. Yeah. And it's like, this is hilarious that if you go back in 2006 and watch The Craig, like it's still a great movie and it still holds up fantastically well. But the tech is just like, that's a weird phone. Like, why isn't it? Like there'd be kids who watch that and be like, why does it have buttons?
No, it is interesting seeing films are really nice kind of representation of our predictions versus reality. And it's nice to see what people were thinking. And one that stands out to me, and this is actually true of all sci-fi films pre-LCD screens. So, Alien, right? First one, 1979. It's so far ahead of its time. Holy shit. Like, if anyone's listening to this and hasn't seen it, just watch it. It's incredibly good. It's so timeless. But all of the... So, you know, you're in space. They've got this outpost. Like, you've got this giant industrial size, you know, like mining vessel in space. Like, hugely... Like, far more advanced than where we are, right? Maybe Bezos will get us there in the next 20 years. We'll see. But right now, it's still more advanced, or it's being sold as way more advanced. People are living in space routinely. They're on other planets. But yet, all the monitors are CRT monitors.
Yeah.
Right? They're all fat, thick, deep things that are inset into walls. And it's all like the old Commodore 64 green pixels. Everything's green, which now is a really nice retro aesthetic. And I've seen things actually replicate that UI style, because it's become a style now. It's kind of like pixel art used to be a limitation. Now it's a style. But it is funny seeing that. It's like it's supposed to be hundreds of years in the future, but they got CRT monitors. Or you think about Back to the Future 2, iconic for futuristic, you know, visuals, right? You know, flying cars and hoverboards, but no mobile phones, no internet.
Back to the Future 2, when it was made, science fiction. Now, alternate history.
Totally. Yeah, because we've...
Because we're past we've
brushed past it.
Where it was going to be. So now it's not a sci-fi movie. It's an alternate history movie. And it's like, God totally. Damn it.
Yeah, totally. Yes, I love science fiction. For me, I'm pretty biased, I guess, but it's my favorite genre.
Oh, it's 100%.
I think, and I'll make an argument for this, but I think it's the most imaginative genre, purely because it's fiction and it's based around science. So what it requires a good writer to do is not only imagine cool ideas, but how to ground that in futuristic languages, social structures, hierarchies, technology. Like you have to get people to do concept art if you're going to make a film for how that futuristic car you've imagined is actually going to plausibly work. You know, like it's got to have engines and it's got to have a center of gravity. And there is so much more work involved in that. You know, it's like Lord of the Rings is incredibly imaginative, except he doesn't have to come up with swords, right? They already exist. He doesn't have to come up with a lot of the stuff, right? So it's taking medieval technology and kind of putting it magic and stuff magic. You don't have to explain. But science fiction has that need to ground everything somewhat. You know, you look at The Expanse and the amount of detail in that, like before they get into a firefight, they strap into their chairs because obviously they're going to be pulling a lot of G's, you know, in the spaceship. They also wear their spacesuits. And at first, when I first watched, I'm like, why the fuck are they doing that? And it's like, because the chances are that one projectile is going to puncture the hull and they're going to depressurize. So they pre-depressurize before they get into a firefight. So they strap in, put their suits on, they depressurize the whole ship so that when they get punctured, there's no depressurization, right?
Yeah.
And they're flying and there's like tungsten rounds like piercing the hull. And because it's zero G, you get flecks of like molten steel from the hull, like flecking through, like in tubes, like as yeah. it's punching holes. And it's like, and they wear magnetic boots. And every scene that someone's on a space station or a spaceship, if you listen, it's tuned down from the dialogue because otherwise it'd be annoying. But you can hear...
Yeah, the echo walking. Through the suit, because that's the only way you'd hear the sound, right?
Yeah, and you can hear the magnetic boots clipping to the ground. And you have to think about that because otherwise you've got this plot hole of like, well, why is there gravity? You know, and so they just go magnetic boots and they can't let go of that detail. Once it's you know, you have to think through all of that. How are people going to live?
I think the need for the realism in science fiction is definitely increased. So, like, if you go back and watch stuff from the 80s, no one gave a fuck. It was just like because science, and they're like, okay,
yeah, totally.
Like, you didn't need, like, well, if you look at something like Star Wars, right, versus Star Trek. Star Trek, objectively, much more grounded in science. So the idea of like a warp drive and stuff is now grounded in an actual scientific theory. It's called a Cuvier drive. Admittedly, it was the reverse. They didn't copy it from a Cuvier. Cuvier was apparently a massive massive Star Trek fan and wanted to figure out how the idea of a warp drive could be real. And that's how
life imitates art.
Yeah. So that's how he came up with the original like mathematical theory of how his warp drive would work, and in theory it works. Like in mathematical theory, it actually is a thing. It's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you look at like Star Wars, which they just have light speed. But if we look at it now, light speed still doesn't make that much sense in like the span of like distance that they're traveling in that universe. Because it's like if you're traveling at the speed of light. Across the galaxy would still take phenomenal amounts of time. So it still doesn't make sense.
From here, if you're like, Chris, let's go to the center of the galaxy, light speed, 50,000 years.
Yeah, exactly. It's years and years of thousands of millennia too long. Like, it's too long.
Totally. Right? Longer than recorded human history.
So, whereas like the idea of a warp drive, technically, because you're folding space in on itself, it's technically doable. It just requires an unbelievable amount of energy. But again, they were both made around the same time, but I think Star Trek always tries to ground itself slightly in some kind of science. Like, they bend the science quite a lot. Whereas Star Wars is because they do, and you're like, okay. But the cool thing with science fiction, obviously we like fantasy because we talk about Lord of the Rings all the freaking time. But I always liken science fiction to a marriage of fantasy meets like westerns, because the reason why people like westerns is because it's like that final frontier, you know, it was like it was the Wild West and it was an adventure
it's
thing.
It's a bit lawless.
Like, yeah, whereas like that's kind out. Of what science fiction it's ends innovation. Up being and why something like Firefly was so popular and still is.
Oh,
so
and
popular.
That went literally like the that Western went literally route. It was like a very intentionally space,
right? And that's why it was so popular, and why I like The Mandalorian, because it's based on a spaghetti western. It's great, but yeah, it makes a good point that as to why westerns and science fiction and fantasy and science fiction all have a lot of crossover, and I think why science fiction is popular and why I think it's got more popular because people are starting to realize that it represents a lot more different, or it can represent a lot more different sort of story types. Like you could easily do a full fantasy thing in space quite easily, right? Like I've just started playing the Mass Effect Legendary Edition, so I've got all three Mass Effect games.
Oh, nice.
And I love Mass Effect. It's such a good series. Plugged it. And it's a great story from like BioWare. But, you know, like you can easily do like, oh, these are elves, these are orcs, these are like, you could make those comparisons quite easily. And like, that's a very...
Oh, it maps. Yeah. Because everything's influenced by
everything
else.
Totally. And that's a fairly grounded science fiction story with regards to like the technology. They obviously did some very serious leaps, but at least they tried to explain why. Whereas like I think back in the day, like in the 80s and stuff, again, light speed. And that's why. That's just why.
Oh, totally. Yeah, it's Mass Effect, I remember there's some detail. Like I when I played through it, I didn't read everything. There's a lot of extra stuff you can read. But I remember reading something about someone even thought about how it's the Normandy, isn't
yes,
it? That's their ship. That's his ship, right? Commander Shepard. And the way that someone had thought about how it would cool its engines. And so it talks about there's schematics and stuff you can read where it describes how there are pipes that run on the outside of the ship in space because space is much colder than the inside of the engines. And it actually pipes through the coolant through those pipes so that it basically diffuses heat out into space and rapidly cools as the coolant goes back in. And it's like someone, and that's kind of what I was touching on at the start of this, is that with science fiction, it's more expected and more valued that someone would sit and think about that, even though a player or a viewer, if it's a film, may never, ever, ever come across that and they may not care about it. It, at the very least, informs a visual design of the ship and your brain will look at it and go, oh, that looks plausible. Even if I'm not a mechanical engineer, it looks like something that could work. And it's because someone's thought about that, and lo and behold, underneath, it probably could work because someone has thought about things.
I think thought needs to go into it, like a science fiction story, to make it grounded. Whereas, like, you could, because I think now people want, you know, with in the age of information and the level of access that we have to all of this information, like, someone would look at the Normandy and go, "How does it cool its engines? Like, it doesn't make sense."
Yeah,
and then
totally.
Someone's like, "Oh, actually, it does this." And you're like, "Ah, okay, that's fine." You don't need like an in-depth explanation. You just need a real surface level.
But you need an explanation.
Yeah, exactly. You need to know something as to why. And you're like, okay, that's fine.
It's just some kind of pseudoscience as well. It's like it just satisfies the question.
Yeah.
I think is enough, right? It creates a logically, an internally like logically consistent framework that things can push against. The ideas can push against each other.
It's one of
the
things that the Marvel Cinematic Universe sort of gets away with a little bit, because obviously like, the original movies there, like they did try and, like, even if you look at the original Thor, they tried to ground it in science somehow. And I kind of respect that attempt of what they've done. Obviously, if you look at the stuff now, it's sort of just like, okay, it does this because it does. Like, if you look at something like the Infinity Stones, like, yeah, there's a backstory to the Infinity Stones and okay, fine. You're right. Fair enough.
Yeah.
You know, like, you just, okay.
They're definitely more on that edge of like pure fantasy.
Yeah, like pure fantasy. Like they're definitely pushing the limits of technology and stuff. But you're like, I'm fine with this. I'm fine with it. Like at least you made. Yeah, there was an attempt.
If you go to, if you go to that, and that's kind of what it wants to be. Because I'm very, very big on assessing the success of a piece of fiction based on what it is trying to be and how well it achieves what it wants to be. And I think that, so, and what that does is it divorces me from whether or not I like a thing. So I can not like it because it's not for me as a viewer. It's not something that I'm interested in, but I could still say it's extremely successful because it's trying to be a B-grade film and it actually achieves it. Whereas other movies that try to be B-grade intentionally for that ham-fistedness, they'll fail and they'll be cringy. And so you can kind of assess it on its own merits. So it's like, okay, if the Marvel film sets out to be this, how well does it be the thing it wanted to be? And if it achieves that, then it could be a 9 out of 10 rating, even if I don't like it personally, because it succeeded, right? It's like, this is what we want to make, and we made it, and it is exactly that thing. And you see examples of where that fails, or, you know, so The Last of Us 2 was a huge thing last year, massively divisive, you know, because the plot went in a direction and there was certain treatment of characters that fans didn't like, because fans want what they want from their beloved IP, but they don't own the IP. The creator owns the IP. So the creator goes, okay, this is where the story's going to go. This is going to happen to this character. And people go, but I didn't want that to happen to that character. And there were people on the internet saying that because that happened, it's bad writing. And I like to make a distinction between, is it bad writing? Is bad writing the same or different to you liking it?
Yeah, totally.
So just because the plot did something that you don't agree with doesn't mean it's bad writing. It could be fantastic writing, but you don't like it. And these can be two completely separate things.
I should point out that this line of thinking doesn't apply to The Last Jedi, because that was bad writing and it was a shit movie.
Oh, no, totally. You can totally objectively, you can pull down both sides. Fucking oath. You can pull down both sides of that coin. But I remember trying to get into conversations with people about this, because they're like, well, it's a bad game and it's bad writing. And it's like, okay, I actually appreciate what it did. I could see what they were doing. It's quite profound. There's so many layers there, which we could get into someday once you play it and see it and get exposed to it. It's ahead of its time. But what I was trying to explain to people is there's kind of two sides. There is the success of it as a piece of art, okay, which is the writing and the ambition and the kind of point in the message and the experiment that's going on with what they're trying to do. Then there's the commercial product. So arguably, because it alienated a lot of audience and people canceled pre-orders and people took it back and whatever, arguably is a commercial product flawed, okay, because the goal of a commercial product is to be widely appealing and to sell lots of stuff, okay? But it can be at odds with the art side of it. So wildly successful as a piece of art, perhaps less successful as a commercial product. But people conflate these as if they're the same thing. It's like, okay, it didn't do what I wanted, therefore it's bad quality. And I don't agree with that. I think those two things could be separated. Absolutely. Oh,
absolutely. Like, it means if anything, if you're hating that like a character died or something, it's arguably good writing, because it's like, if you have that level of an emotional reaction to a story, and I think we did talk about this with specifically on The Last of Us, that if you're having that level of emotional reaction, there was probably some really good writing both before and when this particular instance was written, because you were that invested in the story.
Absolutely. But,
you know, then, okay, we can look at something like The Last Jedi, and where a lot of people don't like it, some people do. But the writing there just didn't make sense. Like there is whole chunks of that movie where clearly Rian Johnson just wanted to do something and he did it. Like the start, the thing that bothers me the most is like the bombing scene right at the very start of the movie. It doesn't make sense. Uh-huh. There's no reason for it, but he wanted to do a World War II bomber scene. That's exactly what he said. I wanted to do a bomber scene from World War II. I'm like, well, then fucking make a World War II movie. Don't make a World War II movie in space. It doesn't make sense. You wouldn't do a bombing run against a giant ship. There's no reason for it. It doesn't make sense. Yeah,
so it becomes logically inconsistent.
Yeah.
And that's someone just abandoning the internal logic for their own want, which I think if you're going to try to make that, if you want to do that badly, you have to find a way. You have to consult the internal fiction of that world, and you have to negotiate with it to work out whether or not it has anything to offer to make that work. And if it doesn't, abandon ship.
Yeah.
Like, pun intended, but fully abandon ship at that point, because it's like you're running against the grain of this internally consistent logic. And if you're holding an IP as important as Star Wars, where it's going to be official canon, there's also a responsibility to treat that with care, because once you enter that in, it's concreted into the history.
And I definitely think, I feel for the guys who get, you know, put as directors and stuff of the Disney Star Wars now, because you're right, there is a much higher level of risk and stuff there.
Totally.
And like obviously someone like Rian Johnson wanted to make it his own, and he has every right to do that. But you've got to also take into account what's happened before it and what's possible within the universe that you're making a movie into. So, and that's why they've stopped and delayed so many Star Wars movies that they were originally planning, because Disney's just gone, We can't just make a movie, slap Star Wars on it, and people will go and see it. Like, yeah, they'll go and see it. But if we keep doing this, we're going to kill the franchise. And they paid literally billions of dollars for it. So they're going to milk it for everything it's worth.
Yeah,
it's like
$3 or $4 billion, wasn't it? Yeah.
But if they kill it before it's sort of...
makes a return.
Yeah, so they need, I think, you know, and that's what they've done with The Mandalorian. And I think The Mandalorian's great because they've realized, oh, Spaghetti Western in space, let's set it just after Return of the Jedi.
It taps into the original.
Yeah, and it feels like the originals. And it's a good series. You know, like, same with Star Trek Discovery on Netflix here in Australia. It's, I really like it. I think they, you know, they're definitely pushing the boundaries and kind of where they are now, love it or hate it. But yeah, I think the direction they're taking with that's really good. I like it. It feels like a Star Trek IP. You know, they really double down on the sort of what the Starfleet thing is and what it's all about. And I really like that because it's, you know, it was originally set in sort of like Kirk Spock era. So, you know, like the height of Starfleet sort of thing. And, you know, then you've got, I'm not sure if you have watched it, but there's an animated series as well on Prime called Lower Decks.
And
it's a bit of a piss take, but it's literally about like the crew members in the lower decks of one of these ships, because it's like all of the stuff focuses on the bridge crew, but these ships have like hundreds to thousands of people running
engineers
them.
And
so it's like these are the lower deck crews of just like the ensigns who have to do all the shit jobs, and it's pretty funny.
The shovel the coal into the steam engine.
So it's a bit of a funny look at just that whole universe, and it's a bit of fun. So it's a bit more of a lighthearted take on Star Trek, but it still feels a little bit Star Trek-y, which is a bit of fun. And then I've tried to start watching Deep Space Nine, which is, if you look on, because I watched Next Generation, obviously, as we spoke about last year, and I really liked it. And I was like, okay, what do you watch after Next Gen? Because I don't think I could go back to the original series; it's a bit too old. But if you look at like best Star Trek series lists online, and if you Google them, Deep Space Nine always like hits the top of the lists in most of them. So
Super popular.
So I'm going to start watching Deep Space Nine. There you go.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, crack onto it. There's something actually I've started watching just recently, which is brand new and it's still airing every week. It's the first thing that's convinced me to sign up to Apple TV, which I hate because I've now added another fucking streaming platform. But it's fantastic so far. It's 4 episodes out. It's called Foundation. Have you seen anything?
I've seen the trail sort of, because I've got Apple TV as well, because I got a free trial when I got my phone, I think.
Nice. Yeah. Well worth checking out. So based on sci-fi novels by Isaac Asimov. If you don't know him by name, he's responsible for coming up with the widely touted 3 laws of robotics, if you've ever heard of those.
Yeah,
you probably did, having worked at Tesla. So it's like, you know, the first rule is that a robot may never harm another human being directly or indirectly. The second law is that a robot must always follow commands from a human unless it violates the first law. And the third law is you must always protect yourself unless it violates the second or the first law.
Yeah.
And that came from him. And he was a science fiction writer and kind of a philosopher in a way. And he wrote Foundation. And there's a whole bunch of novels. I think he published the first one in 1942. So I love how forward thinking some of these people are that we've created on this planet. I mean, this is fantastic high sci-fi. And it was inspired by him. He was reading about the fall of Rome.
Right.
And which makes sense because there's a lot of parallels to that, even visually. But it's like sci-fi Rome. And so it's about this, the empire, right? Just generically the empire. And they've been ruling for like 20,000 years. There's about 25 million worlds in the galaxy that are populated. And they are the central power, authority, like police force kind of empire, right? And in a bid to keep things going the way that one of the leaders wanted, 400 years previously, he basically created this initiative where he's recloned every time. So now it's the same emperor for the last 400 years. And that's going to keep going in perpetuity because he was a very good leader and whatever. But it starts to explore ideas around, is there value to the gene pool changing? Is this going to cause stagnation within the empire? And the linchpin, the thing that kicks it all off, is there's this character who's a mathematician and he has this fictional branch of mathematics called psychohistory, and he kind of invented it. He's the only one that really understands it. And it predicts trends at a societal level. And he sees the fall of the empire coming within 500 years. And it's going to be about 30,000 years of turmoil in the galaxy as everything, all the social structures collapse. And he comes out with that and tells them about it. And then they hold him to trial because they think that he's basically like a clairvoyant that's trying to inspire people to usurp them. So it's going to lower confidence. He's basically he's like an end of days prophet kind of thing, but they won't listen to him. And he's like, there's nothing you can do to stop this. The only thing you can do is to try to slow it down. And so I have this plan. And if you let me, if you don't kill me after this trial, if you let me, we should back up human knowledge somewhere else, right? So that when this happens, that out of the rubble of that, humanity doesn't have to start over from scratch. That there'll be an Encyclopedia Galactica with all human knowledge. And that will actually shorten the 30,000 year turmoil window down to about 1,000 years. We could get back to kind of where we were.
Mm.
And that's the setting. And it's fantastic so far. It's amazing. The visuals are incredible. It's such high production quality. The guy who plays the Emperor is the guy in The Hobbit who plays the Elf King from... I can't remember what part of the Elf realm he's from.
He's the Wood
Elf. Legolas's father.
Yeah,
the Wood Elf King.
He's also, he's the bad guy from the original Guardians of the Galaxy.
From the original Guardians?
Yeah, original Guardians of the Galaxy. He's the he's like the main bad guy with the hammer. Same dude.
Is he really?
It's the same guy.
Is that him?
Yeah, same guy.
Is that him? Yep. Oh my God. I didn't know that because he was so made up.
He's done a few roles like that where you're just like, what?
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's great.
He's perfect for these roles because he has this really odd godly air about him. A little bit cunty, if I may say. But he plays that really, really well. He's got this pompous, godlike air about him. And he's so good for these roles. And he's great as this empire, the emperor of the empire in Foundation. Only 4 episodes out so far, and it's super, super good. So I'd highly recommend checking that out. It's also pretty low on, it doesn't rely on action too much. There is action, which is good, but it's the style of action that I agree with as being executed well, which is it's there as tension exclamation points. So a lot of it deals with the politics and the drama and the characters and what they're going through and how they relate to this situation and the existential nature of life and what it means to die and what it means to go on and what does it mean to protect your lineage and knowledge and all these kinds of ideas. And then on the ground level, it's about people fighting each other and what we do to each other when we're desperate. When maybe we torture too many innocents because we think that we're sending the right message, but that's going to cause problems later. And it's fantastic. It's very rich.
His name is Lee
Pace. So I'd highly recommend that.
In case you're wondering.
Lee Pace. Lee Pace. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll have to try to commit that to memory. He's fast becoming an actor that I think I will follow around.
Yep. Yeah, he played Thandrin as the Elven King.
Yeah, he was so good as the Elven King, so good. I tell you another thing I watched recently, it's basically going viral at this point, Squid Games.
Yeah, is it? Because I haven't watched it yet, but I've seen it obviously, and yes, like you said, it's blowing up. What is it?
It's kind of like it's a Korean thriller, and it's basically a horror thriller Hunger Games, in a sense. So the loose plot is there are, a bunch of people who live in the world, like normal capitalist world, and they're crippled by debt. And they get approached on the street by somebody who asks them to play a game. And he's like, every time you win this game, I'll give you 100,000 won, which is their currency, local currency. Yeah. And every time you lose, you give me 100,000 won, right? And then he knows how to play this game really well, so he usually wins the first round, or he does win. And the person's like, well, I don't have the money. He's like, I'll tell you what, every time you lose, I'll refund the 100,000 by slapping you, right? And we'll keep playing. You can win money from me, but every time you lose, I just get to slap you, right? And it kind of shows what people are willing to do when they're desperate because they're standing in public just copping slaps from this guy, right? At the end of that, he gives them a card and he's like, we have a game. We have games where you can win more money like this and we're almost out of spots. So call this number and you can join in. So a lot of people rock up and it turns out to not be what they thought it was, but they've signed contracts. So leaving is not so easy. And then there's a series of games that take place and the trailer doesn't really hide this fact, but it's if you lose, you die basically. Yeah. And so it goes through, I think it's about 10 episodes. And of course, there's layers to this, and you find out who made these games and like why, and you find out more about the people who were in there and their backstories and how they ended up indebted and where the desperation comes from. And you see people climb over each other and fuck each other over and form unions and all trying to survive and get through this. And if you win, you win a lot of money. So there's about 438 people, somewhere around that number, start. And for each person, there's 100 million won allocated. So by the end, if you're the last one standing, you get 100 million won times 438, which is like billions,
yeah.
Right? So it's interesting because they sort of they test human nature in the face of riches. And then, of course, you've got a core kind of character who goes through that, and you're invested in his story and his situation. And there's a bunch of other side characters, and it's really, really good. It's really good visually. It's really good. The music's incredible. Cinematography's great. It's shot really nice. The acting's great. I'd recommend watching it in Korean with subtitles because you get the genuine emotion from the actor. And there's been some translation issues apparently that have come to surface.
Yeah,
the
English I read something dubbing about
that this morning. A little bit. Not on point. It's a little bit softer in the interpretation for some of the lines, so you lose a little bit of the seriousness. But you know, and it's got a little bit of the more Asian cinema, what we perceive as maybe a little bit corny in terms of the dialogue and a little bit of the overacting and stuff. But it's nice; like it works really well. It's really fun. There is actually an episode where they have Western characters, and it's obviously written from their perspective. And it's terrible. It is terrible. They're like rich white men, and they're there kind of watching and spectating, and their faces are hidden behind masks, and it's this whole thing. And they're like, oh, yes, number 42 really seems to be doing good in this one. Oh, I wouldn't trust that. Number 42 is an unlucky number. Like, it's these kinds of... And it's like that. That's not actual dialogue, but that's exactly what it sounds like. And you watch it, and you're like, oh, my... Fucking God, that's so cringy. And it's not because they're bad writers, because the Korean characters are all fine. It all fits, right? But with them, it's almost like their interpretation. It's almost like if I tried to write a Korean character.
Yeah.
Right? And then I had a Korean actor act out my English translated interpretation of a Korean person, it would probably to their ear just sound terrible. Like I wouldn't even attempt it. I'd bring in another writer to write those parts. But it's quite fun. It's quite gruesome, but it has that kind of same gruesomeness as like a Saw film, where it's like a little bit over the top. So it's less. It's some of it's disturbing, but it's a little bit Tarantino-esque, like gore sort of like.
Yeah, right.
So it's a bit up there. The it's a little bit. It's a bit easier to watch because it's a bit too much.
Yeah,
okay. If that makes sense. I find subtle gore to be much harder to watch. In things like recently, I just started watching a Netflix Neil Blomkamp, you know, who did District 9.
Oh yeah, great.
And
film.
Elysium. He has a studio called Oats Studio, and he has done a bunch of short films that are experimental, like 20 minutes, 15 minutes, 5 minutes, and Netflix has just bundled them together as like a season. And Sigourney Weaver's in the first one. That goes for about 25 minutes, and the gore in some of that. Because his style, you remember from District 9, is almost documentary-like.
Yeah, yeah. It was filmed like a... Yeah, it was actually... I think it was filmed as a documentary, District 9, wasn't it?
Yeah. It starts off with the interviews and characters' accounts of... And it just feels so much more real. Something about the way my brain feels about that is much different to a fantastical situation that's shot, like, cinematically. Whereas you take that, and so some of the gore on these short films is like... Oh my, it's like sickening, kind of, because it feels more like a real account, even though it's sci-fi and there's aliens and weird shit compared to Squid. So Squid Games, I found to be quite easy to watch. It's fun. It's fun. So you should definitely watch it. The hype is well earned.
Yeah, right.
It took him 9 years to get, or 10 years roughly, to get the script put into production. He wrote it in 2009.
Wow, that's and pretty,
couldn't get
that's dedicated.
Anyone, couldn't get anyone to listen. Couldn't get anyone to listen, right? 10 years
like
later,
Deadpool.
It's now a cult phenomenon.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of talk now in the industry around, okay, well, how does something this good not get looked at? You know, it's kind of like J.K. Rowling pitched Harry Potter to umpteen publishers and, you know,
no,
it's kind of like...
pick it up.
biggest regrets of their life, because huge cult phenomenon, right? Hugely profitable, hugely famous, right? It's become a whole world in itself. Squid Games has kind of had that similar viral effect where everyone's just like, holy shit, have you seen this thing? And it's really cool in the West because it's foreign. And I think that's great. I think it's great that a foreign thing from the East has done so well.
Absolutely.
Here. But it begs the question of, like, you know, some people have more exposure and we just keep hiring the same old people to make stuff. And maybe there's really, really good stuff that, why isn't it being looked at properly?
Because no one wants to, like, I guess what else film, like, no one wants to take the risk on an unknown when they could make something that sort of they know will kind of at least print a little bit of money. Because it's totally. Like, anyway, we've talked about this before, but at the end of the day, it's a business and there's got to be a line there. But yeah, I agree. Like, take a chance on some stuff. And I think what we said, like, make 9 remakes, but then make one, just have a shot in the dark and have a risk on something, because you never know. That might be the next Harry Potter, or it might be the next, you know, Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, you just don't know unless you make it.
Totally.
And that's...
And at the very least, you'll learn and refine the craft.
Yeah, exactly.
So the worst that'll come out of it is the experiment should yield maybe the next thing that you do because of that, because that failed. It inspires the next idea,
totally.
Which actually becomes the success.
Yep.
People do love new things. When they land, new things will always blow up bigger than existing things, right? It's just that that existing things have a predictable kind of radius of effect. But yeah, you look at something like this and it's just come out of nowhere and it's just blown up. Netflix, I think something that streaming is doing is giving that kind of experimentation more space than it's had in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I will say one thing that Netflix does, though, is... They make a lot of stuff, and they basically do a scattergun approach where it's like, if we make fucking everything, something's got to land. But some of the stuff they're bringing out is just awful.
Oh, totally.
But then they'll
make
House of Cards.
Yeah.
Or something
like that. And arguably, if they didn't make all of that, then the ones that are really good wouldn't be made either, because it would change the entire psychology of how they approach this.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Those things would probably get clamped off as well. Absolutely. It's like I read a book by Peter Thiel called From Zero to One, and it's about how to effectively start a startup. And he was one of the earliest investors in PayPal and eBay. He's a billionaire. And he's an angel investor now. And he talks about what he looks for, you know, when he invests money in a startup. And he sort of said that based on the math, right, you'll lose 9 out of 10 times or 9 out of 20 times or 19 out of 20 times. But because the turnaround of that one, if you invest in that one unicorn correctly, it will make the losses back and then some from the rest. So the scattergun approach is kind of the same for Netflix. If 9 out of 10 they make don't hit, they just need the one. The one will hit so big that it'll be worth
pays
that
for the rest
risk,
of it.
Right? But they may not have found that. It's kind of like going on a gold finding expedition. You dig 1,000,000 holes. You only need to find a gold vein once for that to be worth it. But if you didn't dig all those holes, you wouldn't have gone there to find the gold vein.
Yeah.
So you have to do that. Yeah. So yeah, I think that's, I think they're giving space to things, which is really good.
And hopefully they'll give space to all of the cool new podcasts that are coming out. <including ours.
laughs> Not biased or
not
anything.
Not biased or anything. Well, I mean, it depends on how much money they throw at us.
Hey, Netflix.
Yeah. What's up?
Are you listening?
Don't think we would Netflix. Be a very good story on Netflix, but hey, you never know. They are putting out some pretty bad stuff, as we said. Thanks so much for listening, guys. This has been episode 8 of The Nerd Pub. Give us a like on Apple Podcasts. Feel free to give us a review. We are on Instagram, although there's nothing on it yet. We are going to eventually rectify that. Find us on YouTube as well. Feel free to like, subscribe, give us a comment in one of the videos. Let us know what you want us to talk about. And we will see you in the next one.